Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about Apocalypse Now, the 1979 film directed by Francis Ford Coppola, written by John Milius, Francis Ford Coppola, based loosely on the novel Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, joined by the Lessons from Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So this is an entry in our new series of someone from the team picks a movie and forces everybody else to watch it. And I picked this movie because, shockingly, several of the team members had not seen it. I'm not going to name names. And so the reason I picked Apocalypse Now, I have this very strange relationship with this movie. And it, I think it has everything to do with when I saw it and like the context in which I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was around post-high school, like, but pre-college, like right in that, like, I'm becoming like a real person phase. And, you know, as a straight edge high school kid, I wasn't allowed to like watch R-rated movies. So like, suddenly this new world opened up to me. And my dad had always talked about this movie, and he was really good at like telling, like basically creating tall tales around things. And so there was just this like weird built up lore with this movie of it's this insane movie where the experience was just like actually being in the war. And there was this documentary made about it, but no one can find it anymore. It doesn't exist. And like all this. So just like as a kid, I'd heard about it. And so there was this build up of like Apocalypse Now.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't remember exactly how it happened, but somewhere in college, I was on, you know, the totally legal places that you go when you're downloading movies in college. And I found like a grainy copy of The Making Of, which is called Hearts of Darkness, which we're going to have to talk about. And so I watched the movie and watched the movie again and then watched The Making Of and just like the experience of that and being exposed to something like this for the first time. And then coupling that with the crazy making of story just left a very intense, lasting, but kind of vague and murky impression. So going back and rewatching it, it was interesting because I was like, okay, right, because I don't remember a ton about what happens in the movie. And even now, just having watched it the other day, I feel like I'm still kind of in this weird daze of like, but what is this movie and what is this experience? And I think that's one of the things that's very unique about it. So I'm curious for those of us who are watching it for the first time, what your experience was for it. I'm not going to name names. I'm going to randomly
we're going to reveal ourselves. It's not a secret. Yeah, it's not a secret.
Right. So anyone on the team that's watching it for the first time this week, what are your thoughts, Trisha?
Michael, hold on. Michael, this is your chance to get back at us for all the times. Get back at them for all the times.
Wow.
They throw you under the bus for not
having seen
something.
Revenge isn't my bag. That's just not what I'm into.
Well, I have a little bit of a disclaimer on myself here because in a recent podcast, we got asked about like, what are the big movies, a Patreon exclusive podcast. We got asked about what are the like gaps in your like viewing history that you're really embarrassed about, like what movies you haven't seen. And so I went through the AFI Top 100 list, and there's like three or four Vietnam War movies on that list. And I had seen exactly zero of them. Like, I just haven't seen the Vietnam War movies for whatever reason. And this is like, to me, always been the most glaring of like, so I've obviously also missed Platoon. You can yell at me about that. I also haven't seen Full Metal Jacket. Like, so those, you know, those are the ones. I haven't seen The Deer Hunter either. Like, it's just, it's that,
right.
It's that somehow perfect storm of like, I don't know, Vietnam War movies. But I was really glad that you picked this one because I've been meaning to see it. Although when I watched it over the weekend, I was sick. I had like a stomach flu, which I do not
perfect.
Recommend. It's
that seems weirdly perfect.
It was so nightmarish, like phantasmagorical, just like hell that I was in. I made it about as far as like Ride of the Valkyries, and then I was like, I gotta go lie down. This is too much. Do not recommend. But it's astonishing. I mean, I was blown away just by how it looks and the scale of the production and just the vast cinematography and the landscape and the commitment to the like commitment to every single tiny part of it. It it just blows you away when you're looking at just even what's in like any given frame and how amazing it looks. Just like, it's never going to be like probably one of my favorite movies because it's not that fun to watch. And I also had this horrible experience watching it, but I just respect the hell out of it. It's incredible.
There's like an audacity to
every single frame. It's so audacious.
Like, what did you just do, Coppola? Like,
right.
Over the course of, you know, nearly a year, basically. But Alex, what did you think?
Say, yeah, similar experience. I'm really happy that I watched it at, I'm actually currently staying at my family's house in Arizona, where they just got a gigantic OLED TV, OLED TV. And like, I brought my nice speakers from LA to install here as surround sound, because I live in an apartment and we can't play things really loud anyway. So I watched it with like super loud, like subwoofer surround sound, a giant 4K screen, and Apple TV has it in 4K, like Dolby Vision. Mm-hmm. It was like a movie theater experience, which I think is how you should watch this movie. And I was so blown away, especially by like just the sound, like the sound of the choppers right up front. I was already like, oh, I'm in for like a cinematic just journey here. And by the end, I feel like I was in an altered state.
Yes.
Like I really
it does
felt
that
like,
to you.
Mm-hmm. I really felt like the movie had taken me into like a fever dream, and mm-hmm. I didn't know where I was, but it was, I trusted it. I felt like I was in good hands. And so I was along for this ride, and I feel like I should have watched it more than once. Like I don't mm-hmm. know if I can even process it properly mm-hmm. upon a first viewing. Mm-hmm. But I just know, yeah, there was so much in there. And yeah, and some of those set pieces is early on in the film, I'm like, wait a minute. Like, they had to actually do all this.
Yeah.
What? Wait, they did all this? I don't mm-hmm. understand. You can do that? What?
Yeah.
I was consistently thinking that as I was watching it. Like, what? They did this? What?
It's crazy. I mean, and that's the thing when you watch the documentary, which I was still sick. When I was, it was the next day, but I was not feeling well. And as I'm watching the documentary, relating so hard to everybody in it, where I'm just like, me too, you guys. But it is just, you see, you know, the famous quote by Coppola, which was like, we had access to too much money. We were in the jungle, and little by little, we went mad. You get that feeling when you watch it. It drives you crazy.
There is a weird, I want to hear your thoughts, Brian, but just since we're talking about the going crazy thing, there is this weird kind of phenomenon, it seems, that happened within this like 10-year period where Apocalypse Now and Blade Runner and The Shining are kind of all these landmark movies where the production was just as insane as the movie. And those are so mixed together that they're kind of, you can't pull them apart.
It's mm-hmm. like energetically imprinted on the film, like the mood of the set and like the weirdness of it all. You know, there's something that got transferred.
Yeah, I didn't realize how publicized every bit of this production was, where people were like following along with the production.
Right. That's one of the most different things from then to now, is like, you don't turn on like the 6 o'clock news and they're like, oh, you know, production on Black Widow got da da da. And, you know, like, they're not doing like a piece on it with like Tom Brokaw coming on and like seriously, like sternly talking about the production of a film.
Yeah. But so, Brian, you had seen it before, right?
I had, but only once, and quite a long time ago. So it was really, really a treat to go back and watch it with fresh eyes and really, like, I know where this movie is going, but I can just sort of sit and enjoy each little piece of it as it was going along. And I just found myself just blown away. Like, even for a movie I had seen before, just every explosion and choreographed helicopter and everything, but then also just the individual moments, the acting, the characters, the story, mm-hmm. the theme, obviously, and just everywhere it goes. It, you know, it's a 2.5 hour movie, and I was just completely just with it the entire time. So I was really, really excited to go back and watch it again.
Yeah, when we make epics these days, you know, where the whole crew travels to like some foreign location, like think about like Lawrence of Arabia and stuff like this, these mm-hmm. epics, when we make them these days, they don't have this sense of scale that movies from around this time do, that are like so immersed. I feel like these days when we think about epics, it's like half of it is CGI and like it's pieced together in these different locations. And so what we're talking about, the like texture or the mental state, and part of the reason, of course, in this case is that there was just so many drugs being done on set constantly, but like notoriously, but that stuff, when you put your entire crew, like send them to a foreign country and leave them there for nearly a year, it like their the entire spirit of that like seeps into what feels like the scale and the psychology and just like every other part. And also, of course, they built all of those huge sets. Like, you get the sense of the work that's being like poured into it. And I don't know, it somehow comes through, and it, epic is that word for it.
Mm-hmm. I also think that a lot of times when you hear these stories about a director put too much of themselves in the movie, they tried to make it too personal, then the movie ends up not being good. And I think that Coppola was able to, he knew what he wanted, but he was very loose with his directing style, and just, you know, he had people improvising, he changed his mind, and obviously things didn't happen the way they wanted it to. They completely changed the ending. And then I guess maybe a more sober Coppola then later did the editing and said, okay, now what do we have here, and how can I actually turn this into a solid film? Because he doubted he was even making a good movie, you know, as the documentary leans into. But I think it's very impressive that it's still thought of as one of the best movies of all time, considering how hard the production was, but also considering how sort of stubborn he was a lot of the time about compromising and not doing things the way that he wanted to do it.
Yeah.
I feel like there, you can sense that, like, I think watching this again, you know, knowing all the craziness that happened on set and, you know, the way they had to shoot certain things, I feel like you can feel a certain amount of, this movie was made in the edit. Like, someone was given too much film, but luckily they were able to figure out how to put the pieces together to make it into a thing that resonated with people. And I think that's, you know, there's just no guarantee that that's what was going to happen. And I feel like that's what's kind of also adds to that miraculous thing about it, where it's somehow all that insanity was then also able to be arranged and sometimes kind of like not clunky or sloppy, those are the wrong words, but
it's kind of episodic. It doesn't really feel like it has a strong narrative through line all the time. I mean, there is the one the singular goal, you know, going up the river to assassinate this one man, but on the way it's pretty murky,
and it like leans very heavily on voiceover to the point where it feels like a noir. I had never really clocked that before, but it's just, it's a lot of Martin Sheen sitting and thinking and looking at things and talking to himself. But like,
does anybody know if that's different in like the Redux or the final cut? I was wondering if it was like a Blade Runner situation. Where did
I imagine it can't be? I think the voiceover is too important to the movie, because I was thinking about, like, you have this whole sanity as a setup kind of thing, where like the first 10 minutes you have Willard and he's just totally bonkers, and then he is sent to go kill someone who is crazy. So you see him sort of normal and then do his descent into madness basically over the course of the movie. And I think the voiceover, I think this is one of the best movies actually for proof that voiceover works really well if you know what you're doing, because not only would it be silly to try to change his thoughts into dialogue where it's like now he's talking to a crew member and he's like, well, I can't help but think about Kurtz and his kids or whatever, you know? But then also it does this really cool thing where you're listening to Kurtz's recordings at the beginning and then you're listening to Willard's voiceover, and then at one point he is reading Kurtz's letters, so his voiceover is now Kurtz's voice.
Exactly.
So it really blurs the line between those two things. I just think that really the voiceover is like not only a helpful tool, it's also actually used for a purpose in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is doing something thematic, as you're pointing out, Bri. But I think it's interesting, too, that it has a distinctively different voice, right? Because there was a different writer who wrote the sections of voiceover. And it was a decent amount of it was recorded by somebody else as well. Joe Estevez was recording some of the voiceover, Martin Sheen's brother. Willard has... the way that he speaks to the crew members is just this sort of like abrupt, not, you know, very, very cagey, not friendly way of being around them, which works for the character and makes a ton of sense. as you're pointing out, Brian, it would undercut that to have him like explain his thoughts to them. Mm. But also it's a dramatically different character voice. The way that Willard speaks to himself in his own head is dramatically different than any way that he speaks to anybody else. And right. of course is more like the way that Kurtz talks. So yeah, it's really cool. It's well thought out as a device, not tacked on trying to fix something that
exactly
right.
can't be right. fixed.
mm-hmm. It's so front loaded also, like the film begins with you're in his head and you're insane and right. you know, with the helicopters and the ceiling fan and just like one of the most iconic openings.
You're in Jim Morrison's head and then you're
exactly.
And so yeah, you see like you hear and see what his internal life is, and then he's like called to go like meet with real people mm-hmm. and be presentable. And I think just that juxtaposition adds so much to that interaction, as does Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
It's young Harrison Ford.
So beautiful.
That intro just sets the tone for the movie too. Yeah. You know, like it's just, okay, this is the kind of movie we're getting into. And then, like you said, then suddenly it's juxtaposed with Harrison Ford and G.D. Spradlin is the guy who plays General Corman, who I was like, what do I recognize him from? But I recently watched The Godfather 1 and 2, and he is Senator Geary. The guy who is trying to, you know, Corleone, Michael's like, mm-hmm. you're going to do this and da da da. He says, no, I don't think so. And Corleone basically says, well, you will, or, and then, you know, just the most amazing threat ever on film. And then he's, oh, okay.
Yeah. And Harrison Ford playing Colonel George Lucas, basically. His name is Colonel G. Lucas.
Like, is it? That's hilarious.
Yeah, it is. We see you, Coppola.
I feel like that's almost as hilarious as that, like, at some point, George Lucas was going to
right.
direct Apocalypse right. Now.
What?
I'd
yeah.
forgotten
yeah.
that fact. And, like,
and they were going to film it in Vietnam, like, with yeah. real soldiers or something. Yeah, what?
Right. They were going to film it in Vietnam during the war. It's a right. terrible right. idea.
That's the other crazy thing about this movie is it started production just barely after the war sort of officially ended. Like, we're right on the mm-hmm. tail. It's kind of like watching The Great Dictator or Casablanca, you know, right? Which they're not, hey, let's make a movie 30 years later about the war. It's nope. This is happening now.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Working freelance, whether it's as a writer, filmmaker, podcaster, or director, can have a lot of benefits. You get to have more flexibility and control over your work life. But it also means that the financial side of things is entirely your responsibility to figure out. On Skillshare, you can find a bunch of classes to help you navigate the world of being a freelancer. One simple but important part of freelancing is bookkeeping. So I'm going to recommend the class Bookkeeping for Freelancers, How to Handle Your Finances by Emily Simcox. The class helps you choose the right bookkeeping method for your business, easily categorize and track your expenses, and stay organized throughout the year. I can say from experience that a little bit of organization in the beginning helps out a lot in the long run. This is just one of thousands of classes on entrepreneurship, design, and writing that you can find on Skillshare. And if you use our link, skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay, you get 2 free months of premium membership. So start planning for the future today at Skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. One thing I want to say about that opening that I think ties into why this movie like sticks out in my head when I think about my film history. I don't even remember how it happened, but I was young, I think probably still in high school. And it was like a friend of my mom's had someone that worked at Pixar or something, and they were doing a presentation on film. And so I got to go to this like amphitheater, and it was Walter Murch giving a presentation about editing and the importance cool. of sound in film. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, because I'd never seen Apocalypse Now, but he played the nice. Opening. And I feel right. like that's like that activated parts of my brain that didn't exist before of like, oh, this is what filmmaking is, and this is what sound can be, and like how you can use surround sound and just the imagery and juxtaposition of the ceiling fan spinning and the helicopter mm-hmm. spinning. Like that was just like an awakening,
and all the overlays and transitions and everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's still so powerful. Like so much of this film is also just a crazy technical achievement.
Yeah. Right.
All my these God. Different planes.
I also like that all the overlays and transitions and stuff are saved for transitional moments in the movie. And I think that like that's where it becomes a bad art movie, is when they're used during dialogue and like, suddenly as he's talking, you see this other thing in the back, like that's also being overlaid. It's no, that's not the point of it. The point is sort of while we have some downtime, we can play a little and set the mood and set the tone. But when we're in movie mode, we're in normal movie mode.
That opening sequence sets the tone in terms of like the madness and the journeys that the characters are going to go on. It also sort of like it creates right out of the gate the philosophy of the way that the movie is being filmed in this in the way that it handles spaces, because it's so claustrophobic and disorienting. Like you don't understand the layout of that hotel room. You like, where is the window? Where is the like bureau? And like he's looking at the ceiling, but he's upside down in the frame. It's purposefully disorienting you in the way that the jungle also becomes like disorienting and claustrophobic. The geography is never established. We never have a clear sense of like where they are. Like where are they on the river? Where, what's coming up? Is there a city coming up? Is there more jungle? Is there like a troop? You know, you never have any idea where you are. And that is such a good conscious choice. That's like a projection of the characters' mentalities, especially the further and further they get upriver.
Yeah, I mean, I think something from the documentary that really stuck out to me was Coppola talking about the Vietnam War being like the rock and roll war or the psychedelic war.
Yeah,
because and people were doing psychedelics while stationed in Vietnam, and but even if they weren't doing drugs, I think just the complete confusion and madness of that war, of like, what are we even doing here? What's even happening? Is there a goal? Like I think it, this movie so brilliantly, it's like not just about that, but it like puts you in that headspace, like we've all been saying, in such a remarkable way. And I think part of what I loved about, you know, where the movie went and even how the ending feels is it just feels like it's just emotionally honest to that thing all the way through. And even in those scenes where they're having like a polite lunch to talk about assassinating like this this like acclaimed general, feels kind of trippy and weird. Like the whole thing feels like almost like a bad trip, because you're like, something's wrong with this. Like what
exactly? Like the camera like follows people's hands down to the food that they're eating. Right. And just travels in interesting ways. Really quick, so we keep referencing the documentary, but in case people don't know, there's a documentary called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, that was begun during the filming by Coppola's wife, Eleanor Coppola, and she just filmed everything, and I guess was like secretly recording even conversations with Francis Ford Coppola.
I love her so much for doing that. She was like, he wants me to do this, I'm going to do it.
Right, and she's narrating it later, so it's like she's this educated sweet grandmother kind of talking about these horror moments, and just like, they were murdering caribou, and I thought, come outside, this is beautiful, like what is happening?
Right. Yeah,
and I love how she calls him Francis throughout. Like Francis is doing this, Francis is doing that, and it puts you in the same like intimate space with the director and like with the decisions that are being made. It makes you feel like you're part of the crew or part of the family or whatever it is. And that increases that, like, the feeling to, I don't know, it just puts you right in it, and it's very affecting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's being told from such an intimate, like, relationship place. Like, it's the wife of the filmmaker, and she is also making a film that is just as fascinating, basically.
Right.
And it's just insane how, you know, there's just footage of everything, like the making of all the things. So anyway, there's a million things to talk about in the documentary, and I'm sure we'll keep referencing them. But if you haven't seen it, go watch it. Like, it's intense. It's really intense.
It's an amazing documentary.
Really good.
Just like flat out, just as documentaries go, it is an excellent documentary.
Yeah.
It really reminded me, last year I did a big tour through films and the documentaries about the doomed production, like, pairings. So if you are into this kind of thing, I think I mentioned it before on that podcast, but you can watch From Dusk Till Dawn and the documentary about making it, which is called Full Tilt Boogie. which has a similar feel because they were filming out in the desert. And so it's like, and they were just like out in the desert for months kind of thing. And a set was destroyed. It was burned to the ground, that saloon set. And then Fitzcarraldo, the movie Fitzcarraldo by Werner Herzog, which this movie really reminds me of. Mm-hmm. The documentary about that is called Burden of Dreams. And that is bonkers. And then, of course, Lost in La Mancha is the most, you know, right, sort of well-known example of this. But yeah, if you're into this, you could go ahead and do like a little series on doomed film productions and their accompanying movies. It is really interesting.
Well, because I feel like I was watching something and some filmmaker was saying, I think it was when we were working on Terminator 2 versus Aliens, that video, and watching all the making of stuff and the interviews with James Cameron, and James Cameron saying like making a film is a war. Like it is a war.
Yeah.
And it's like there are just a lot of really interesting parallels. And I feel like this documentary captures that feeling. Obviously the stakes are not merely comparable whatsoever, but like the pressure on the individual upon which everything rides, I feel like is that kind of insane level of pressure.
Yeah.
Well, and there was like a war going on in the Philippines at the time.
Yeah.
So like there was actually war happening like not far away from the production.
Yeah.
Like as if choreographing all those famous helicopter scenes wouldn't be hard enough on its own, because there was a civil war happening and they had made a deal with the Philippines government where they could use their helicopters. But when they needed to go fight, the helicopters would just leave in the middle of the shot and go fight the civil war. And so, like, that was a thing that was happening in the middle of these extremely expensive shots and, like, ruining days of filming. And just, it's...
nightmare.
Insanity.
Typhoon destroying, like, the giant, you know, sets they'd built. And, yeah, it's so crazy.
And I feel like what's so remarkable, as we've already said, but specifically the moment I always think about it is... you know, the famous line from Robert Duvall, who's amazing in this, right? Mm-hmm. I love the smell of napalm in the morning, that little monologue that he gives. That happens in the midst of this like huge wide shot where there's like hundreds of extras, like all the stuff happening, but it's this quiet, intimate moment. And so like for the filmmakers to be there and have everything being as insane as possible, but still commit to doing that moment in this way is just like so intense, but it pays off so well. And I feel like that my favorite part of that line isn't the, you know, the beginning of I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I feel like it's at the end, his last line, where he's just like, someday this
war is gonna end. Change. I want you to surf in the middle of this. You're gonna surf or you're gonna kill. I love, there's so many, there's multiple Godfather cast members here. The guy that I mentioned, and Brando, obviously, and Duvall. And Duvall plays the biggest 180 from Tom Hagen, who is like one of the sweetest, quietest members of the Godfather. And then he does represent the rock and roll war that we're talking about, where he is the character that sort of shows the absurdity of all this and the almost love of being in the middle of this, which makes sense that his big scene is literally in the middle of this wide shot where all this stuff is going on. And I think that during that scene, my girlfriend said, this almost feels like the Coen brothers right now, just the,
right,
the complete absurdity of all this terrible thing, all these terrible things going on. And then yet you have this guy who just is concerned about the waves, and that's the only reason they came to this place. And it also makes the movie more enjoyable to watch because there is this humor between all the crazy. And but yeah, I just feel like one of the reasons that line is so famous and the Ride of the Valkyrie sequence is so famous is because it is one of the most striking moments in the movie, where it's not just look at all this death and everything. That's not what this movie is. This movie is this total roller coaster ride where you never know if you're in silly land or crazy horrible land.
Yeah.
Well, and the combination of the two is kind of the point,
right? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course. And I mean, how marvelously cast is Robert Duvall in this? He's just amazing at it. I was thinking about the introduction of Kilgore when Willard first meets him, and he says something like, he was just one of those guys. You could tell he was going to he's going to come out of the war without a scratch on him, basically. Like nothing could touch him in this war. And you have to have somebody that feels that larger than life, that can embody that just so, so brash. Like he commands the chaos somehow. And so, like, even when literally everything is on fire around him, he's just kind of striding around making declarations and like and there's not a doubt in my mind, and you know, partially because Willard has told us so, but like there's not a doubt in my mind when I was watching that scene for the first time just a couple of days ago, like, that Kilgore was gonna come out perfectly unscathed. Everybody else in this scene, like, it's gonna go to hell in every other way probably, but Kilgore is gonna be absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And so you get that he carves out this space on screen, and that you're just, your eye is drawn to him, and you have to have this character. And I love how early it is in the movie where it's like, this is the war. These are the kinds of soldiers that are fighting the war, or that are in charge of it. They're the ones who are sending people to die. They are the ones who are, like, you know, seemingly above all of this stuff, as Kilgore literally is for most of that sequence. He's above it. Everyone else is dying under him. He's going to be fine. And that's what imbues him with that confidence.
When he's got that kind of cowboy hat Americana thing going on. And I think there's also just, there was a quote in the documentary about how, you know, America likes to put on a big show, you know.
Yeah.
It's like we're showmen. So it's like, yeah, we're going to blast music. We're going to rock and roll. We're going to have like the Playboy bunnies come out and give like a big, you know, concert show. And that mm-hmm. goes all wrong. You know, mm-hmm. it was that like weird, also surreal, but real, like American showmanship, you know, like being mixed in with this like on the ground, like raw horror for the people who are living here. But like,
exactly.
It's almost like the American spirit is like, its mind is focused on the show, not the reality, not the right. actual mm-hmm. on the ground thing happening.
Exactly. Yeah,
definitely.
There is an interesting moment of characterization for Kilgore when you're first meeting him, where, you know, they're in the village or whatever, and there's someone on the ground who's been basically mortally like wounded. And people are
they're holding his guts in with like a bowl.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And the man is like asking for water and no one's giving him water. And Kilgore is like, mm-hmm. any man who's brave enough to blah 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 like can drink from my canteen. And so it's this like weird, intense like selflessness and empathy for, you know, another person. And then someone runs over and is like, this famous surfer guy is over here. Mm-hmm. And he kind of just like drops the canteen and like walks away. Like
right. He like dribbles the water over him by accident and like walks away.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just like so much, like such a broad spectrum of characters established so quickly in that moment.
Whiplash.
It's insane. Yeah.
Well, and it is, again, it goes to the heart of who Kilgore is, because he is part of this like worship of the American soldier, the American like hero, that sort of huge, almost over reverence for like our heroes, you know, honoring all the fallen and all of this stuff, as long as it's convenient to do so, basically.
Right.
And the minute it's not, it's like this ideal that we espouse but don't live up to on the ground. That's Kilgore. And so it's a perfectly designed moment. In addition to the way that it's filmed, which of course is like back from a distance. So we're mm-hmm. almost like in the position of a photojournalist, right? We're like, what a right. great shot that would be to see the general leaning over to give his water to the dying man. Right. Like you get that shot, but then he walks away the minute you get it, you know?
Well, speaking of photojournalist, we have Kilgore in the first act as the sort of representation of this complete patriotism, sort of like loves the war. And then in the third act, you have the reflection, the dark reflection of him in Dennis Hopper, who just plays himself in the movie.
Truly.
Which became very clear in the documentary.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like that you turn off the camera, you're cut, and he's like, man, I don't know my lines, man. Oh, right. You are just Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
And I just love that also in the documentary that at some point Francis Ford Coppola found himself in the situation where he maybe had to direct a scene with Martin Sheen, Dennis Hopper, and Marlon Brando.
And just like, at least two of them are incredibly difficult and like,
right. And maybe insane.
Yeah.
And there's no script, or you can't get them to follow the script.
Oh my God.
Marlon Brando will only just do what he feels. Yeah.
And Dennis Hopper's just like, but like, explain it to me, man. Like, what's it about?
No, like, I'm trying to. You won't let me finish a sentence. I'm trying to explain it to you. I gave you the script 5 days ago. Yeah, man, but I've been busy.
I mean, so I'd always like heard about like Marlon Brando and like Marlon Brando things, but like, my God, like,
yeah,
just like what a person to have to work with.
Yeah. Well, so to set up what they explain in the documentary, which is that, you know, the whole thing is this journey to find Kurtz. And so it's got to deliver once you get there. So Coppola casts Marlon Brando for $1 million a week for 3 weeks total. $1 million of that is just given up front without any work being done. And then Marlon Brando is refusing to adjust the start date because, you know, the movie went long and things changed. And so it'd be like, can we just do this some other time? And Brando was refusing to do that. Coppola had given him Heart of Darkness to read so he would know like what the hell we're doing. Brando shows up, is extremely overweight, hasn't read, is completely unprepared. And it's just like, I feel like that's the point for me in watching the documentary where my brain breaks.
Right.
How can you...
It's all been building to this. Like, this is what it's all about. Yeah.
Right.
And then I think Coppola's attention to detail where he says, okay, if you are overweight, then let's write that into the character. Uh-huh. Let's say you are the most hedonistic and the Brando said, no, I don't want to do it that way. So it's like, okay, I can't make your character not be fat. I don't know how to do
that. So it's like, so all that he was left was like, we'll do 3 weeks of improv. And here
are some big clothes.
I mean, that's what's so insane too, is where it's like he's having to make this insane decision of like, do we stop things to try to write something that will make sense? Or is the better bet to just roll on 3 weeks of improv with Martin Sheen and Marlon Brando?
Which is an interesting discussion to have. It worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the end of the movie is very hazy.
Right.
But it's supposed to be. Kurtz is crazy. Like, if Kurtz was supposed to be this brilliant mathematician, you couldn't say just improv, you know, but you just put the camera on him and say, explain bloodlust. He says, I read that the human animal is the only, or whatever. You know, he says, you have to get to know the horror.
It absolutely works, and I didn't doubt it. You
have to become BFFs with the horror. And then when the horror calls and says, I have to move a couch, you say, I'll be right over. And then you ask the horror, can I get you anything from Starbucks? And the horror says, I'll take a slim mochaccino with a caramel drizzle. The horror.
It's not far off from what was happening. Like, there's raw footage of him like walking away. Just like, I don't know what else to say. I'm not going to come up with any more dialogue today. My back's to the camera. It doesn't matter what I'm saying.
Yeah, that moment where he does, he's just like, I can't think of any more dialogue today. Yeah. And that's like, the end of that. Yeah.
I'm done.
And then also, we're talking sort of the reflection, the symmetry of the movie. The end, you have Brando improvising. At the beginning, you have Martin Sheen doing his best Charlie Sheen impression.
Like, actually having a breakdown in front of a camera crew.
Right. And then actually cuts his hand and says, let's just keep doing this. I need to get rid of my demons right now. And then he has a heart attack shortly thereafter.
The dedication, I mean, that is the hallmark of this movie. And you only have to watch a few frames of it, as we were talking about, to see that, partially because the opening scene, you can tell that the experience that Martin Sheen is having is not acting. I mean, he is as present as he can possibly be, working through his own whatever it is that he's dealing with in that scene. And the unpredictability to what he's going to do is also evident. Like, you wouldn't be able to choreograph the way that he moves around that hotel room. There's no logic to it or anything like that. It's not designed to be cinematic. He's not playing to the camera. He's just in his own mind. And so when you see that level of dedication in the opening scene, everything else in the movie sort of ends up spilling out from that, or like spiraling out. I mean, part of that is just Martin Sheen in every scene, where you now know who he is. And so you know what he's capable of, and you know where he's capable of going. But then everything else is not one bit of it. It is impressively staged as it is, feels like it's done by half measures. Yeah, in some way, not fully dedicated at every moment to Coppola's vision for it. So, as we were saying,
I think a lot of that is Coppola and his sort of very loose style of filmmaking, and that comes through in stuff like The Godfather and The Conversation also. But it's also the decade. Just movies in the 70s had this just rawness and this realness to them that I don't think we've ever really recovered. I think there was like a looseness in the 60s, but not a lot of great films came out of the 60s. Plenty, but not, it wasn't sort of like a decade that's thought of as cinematic. And then the 80s, things got a lot more structured and a little cleaner. And I think the 70s is this really nice marriage between the two, where movies felt like movies, they felt like films, but there was also this rawness and this looseness to the filmmaking that makes it feel like you're just watching a documentary. Like, I remember the first time watching The Godfather, I forget if I talked about this before, but I had to sort of like explain to my brain that the decade this film was being made and the decade this film was set in were two different things. It just felt like what I was watching was what I was watching.
Some of that sense is created by the long, long leash that directors were given by studios at that time.
Right.
Yeah. And that's on full display here. Like, I mean, you know, famously, Coppola was like spending a lot of his own money on this and risking a lot of his own like assets in order to get it made. But at the same time, with these like new Hollywood guys, they were the ones that the studios were writing blank checks to, essentially. And like the cachet of The Godfather went a long way for Coppola, and nobody was like telling him no, basically, once they got out there into the Philippines and they were going. You know, he kept asking for more money and asking for more money. And the studio was just like, okay. And so and not really monitoring how it was being spent, clearly.
Well, that's the thing, the lack of oversight. Like, I think maybe that's part of what was happening in this era also, was just simply like a lack of regulations and a lack of like any kind of like union oversight or things. So things are just nuts, you know, things are just nuts on set.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Somewhat tangential, but relates in that I was just watching a Vox Explained episode about like billionaires and, you know, income inequality and blah, blah, blah. But talking about how, you know, the turn of the century was when, you know, the first billionaires came in, and the inequality that happened there is like vastly more than even the inequality we have now, because it was the first time this thing was possible. And so there weren't, like you were saying, Alex, there weren't regulations, there weren't, like, we didn't know any better, and we didn't know that things needed to be put in check. And I feel like that's kind of behind everything that we're saying here about the 70s, is like film had matured and was reaching like this new level of like awesomeness, but also with a lot of power comes a lot of responsibility. But who was putting the responsibility on there? Like, not
that's
anyone.
The Godfather, right?
That quote? Yeah.
Yeah, the question becomes who is responsible? And this was the era that the director was rising as superstar, which is what we were talking about earlier, where up until this point, directors were just like sort of studio guys, and they just kind of were working within this machine, and no one really, like, they were famous to an extent, but it was really like old Hollywood was really about the stars. It wasn't about the filmmakers, the screenwriters, like, no one, those guys were not celebrities. But then in the 60s and 70s, when this new school of filmmaker rose up, you had the sort of cult of celebrity that was starting to attach itself to the directors. Mm-hmm. And that is what, like, again, yielded some of our greatest movies ever. But like, you know, you have Scorsese and Lucas and Spielberg, and like even people like Malick came out of this school because they were allowed to just make whatever they wanted, pretty much.
Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The studios were just like, this is the guy, write him a check. See what he makes, and it's probably going to be good, you know, and that's where auteur theory comes from as well. And so I'm not lamenting that is over necessarily, but there's no doubt you can't make those movies. Like, you can't make Apocalypse Now. Now.
Right. like the insanity that we're talking about that was actually present for the filmmaking that comes through in the film. Exactly. I don't know how you could recreate that now, because it would be probably illegal.
Yeah.
Right. Or you wouldn't be able to get insurance for it. Or like, right. I mean, I feel like yeah. that's, you know, the Tom Cruise insanity is like probably the closest thing we have of like, sure. what insane thing is Tom Cruise going to do?
Have sure. you heard?
Can't do it in America because they won't insure him. Like,
have yep. you heard what so, he's going to do next?
It's yeah. not going to be in America. So, well,
I don't know.
It's going to be in space.
How high do the borders go?
That's yeah. true. Actually, I think the closest thing we might have to it now is Netflix. For better or for worse, I feel like they are more than most studios just giving people money and saying, go yeah. do yeah. What yes. you want to do. What I like about that is it keeps things from having to be a certain length or have a certain sure. anything to it. People can just make the thing they want to make. And it's still, you know, that also means there's a lot of not great things coming out. Like it's, you can't mm-hmm. sort of like use Netflix as your next thing they do is going to be great, but it also means a lot more people are getting to make what they want. A lot more people are getting work. And I think that that's cool.
Yeah.
For me, it's like, it comes down to, I feel like we hold up these movies as being great because they are, but all of these factors are sort of underpinning why they are great. And the biggest one being this like singularity of vision that you get when you have somebody, a really strong director at the helm, who's also doing the writing or co-writing. But it had all of these, like, of course, drawbacks, because we were getting these voices and we weren't getting a lot of other voices because there was no indie cinema, because you didn't have somebody that's willing to put however many million dollars onto your vision. And so, like, you know, it probably wasn't sustainable, as we see, like, even going into the 80s, it's shifting away from this kind of filmmaking. And so many good things have come out of that shift. The losses
are what they are.
Yep. They are You're what right. they are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
this is kind of a tangent because we're conversations evolving a little bit past the movie itself and just kind of what the movie means and represents. But
sure.
something I was thinking about as we were talking, and Brian, you mentioning, you know, his Coppola's loose way of filmmaking, and something I've always wrestled with as a filmmaker is trying to figure out how I feel about like that kind of filmmaking where Martin Sheen, you're gonna get super drunk and we're just gonna roll and do
slice
stuff.
Your hand up
and right. like there's that, or there's like a hyper controlled, you know, probably animation is like the furthest on the other side where like
sure, there, right.
there's room for, you know, voice performance and, you know, improvisation, but like every frame of every minute, et cetera, has to be, you know, specifically designed. And so like, again, we call all of these things movies. Is there a difference between I've just filmed real life and put it into a narrative? So it's not, I'm not trying to make it a documentary.
Right.
Like, what is that versus the hyper controlled other end of the spectrum? And like, there's probably no reason to reconcile these things. Like, I think it just is what it is, but I've always felt uncomfortable with how I feel about those two things. I'm just curious what your guys' reactions are to that idea.
I think about this with music is, if I sit down to write something, I can try to have this very rigid idea of what I'm going to write, and that can be fine. And then sometimes you jam with your friends and then you see what comes out of it, and something comes out of it you never knew was going to come out of it. And there's a million points in between of just sort of like, oh, I have this general, sometimes you start singing nonsense syllables to come up with a melody. And then one of those nonsense syllables sounds like a word, and that word triggers a theme or an idea that you want to then turn the song into. And I think that you can do that when you're sitting in your room with your guitar, because you're not costing a studio millions of dollars, obviously. but I think that outside of the restrictions of time and money and all the other restrictions, like, it's a complete grayscale. It's a complete sliding scale. And there's no right or wrong answer. It's just really what works best for the artist and what works best for the product that they are the thing that they are trying to create.
Well, and I think there's, I mean, maybe one thing you're trying to get at, Michael, is as a filmmaker yourself, or you know, stuff we're working on, like, is it cheating in a way to like not be the David Fincher, not be the Edgar Wright, who has meticulously planned everything out and is crafting something intentionally and to be the Terrence Malick who shoots, you know, the most the most film. Like, I think on the New World, like, Kodak like sent him like a bottle of champagne because he'd like bought more film reel from them than like any movie ever. So, like, just he just filmed everything and just saw what happened. I don't know that like you can really privilege one over the other, because if the end product is still made with craft and made with intention, ultimately, like we can all tell when a movie is just kind of nothingness. It's just kind of like, oh, this is a pretentious like mashup of what you think is artful, but it means nothing to anybody. Mm-hmm. That's you can say, okay, I don't like that. But if a movie was a miracle that came together from a bunch of accidents, and then a filmmaker put those accidents together and made an amazing thing, I don't think that's any less valuable than, like, you know, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is like the most meticulously crafted movie ever, and I love that it exists.
Right.
But also The New World by Terrence Malick is one of my favorite films. So it's that kind of a thing where I think there's a tendency to like privilege one over the other, potentially depending on your like way of being or what your values are. But I think I want movies to be made that come from both ends of that spectrum, because they can both be very valuable.
Right. Because you are in the editing process, you are then crafting what you've shot and turning that into a movie. If you shot so recklessly, you don't have a movie. Well, then that's not good. But if you have a vision, you have an idea, and you're not sure whether your movie is going to be 90 minutes or, you know, 2 hours or 2.5 hours yet, because you don't know what it is, and you're going to figure that out in the edit, but you are confident you are capturing what you need to capture, I think that's fine.
Yeah. I have a few thoughts here, but one of the biggest ones has to do with respect is what I'm going to go with. Like, because the thing about making a movie is you really are not, even if you wrote it, even if you're the director of it, and let's say you're even producing it yourself and it's your own money. Let's say you have complete control, basically, in some magical world where you're independently wealthy or perhaps a Coppola. But like, let's say that that's the case. Nonetheless, you are not making that movie by yourself. And so it becomes about respecting the other people that are around you as artists and creators and human beings. One of the issues with the New Hollywood School of Filmmaking was abuse of the privileges by these directors who were in no way being put in check.
Right.
We talked about The Shining and the rampant abuse of Shelley Duvall on that production. Because it was just like, well, it's Kubrick. What are you going to do? We have all this money and we're making this movie. And like, and Nicholson's totally unhinged. And like, we're just, you know, rewriting the script as we go along. That is potentially incredibly disrespectful and abusive to the people who are working on the movie with you. I think Terrence Malick is a good example of somebody who, like, probably the last sort of bastion of this kind of filmmaking where he's, you know, sort of making his movies as he goes along. And people know when they sign up to do it that they're like potentially going to spend way more time and energy and whatever on something that might not end up in the movie or whatever. I think it was on, I was reading an article about Knight of Cups where Christian Bale was walking on the beach. You know, he was like giving this like 17 page monologue or something. And then he turned around and Terry was filming a dog that was like running on the beach as well. And it was just like, but that's okay if the actors sign up for that. And if you're clear, like, hey, we are looking for something in the process of doing this. I think that the risk is people like Hitchcock, and who was notorious for not being respectful to his actors as people, and human beings and artists. Like, if you are searching for something, you know, when you listen to Martin Sheen talk about that opening sequence, he's like, you know, it was this like raw experience. It was really visceral, da da da. But even when he says that on the documentary, you get the sense of like, is he glad? Like,
right.
Was he okay with it at the time? Was it not potentially harmful? Or, you know, there's a reason we don't make movies like this anymore. And that's one of those reasons, is that even if what you're doing is costing somebody time and energy that they didn't, because you didn't plan or because that's part of your method, they have to be respected. That's just what it is to be working in a collaborative medium.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think it is just one of those questions that I ask and there is no answer because of everything that we've all just said here. And I think, I guess that's probably ultimately what I find fascinating about it, is that film is this thing that we have a clear idea of, but also it can be anything at the same time. And that's just such an interesting, interesting aspect of the medium.
Yeah.
Before we get back into the movie, I just wanted to mention that we talked in a recent episode about how when you shoot something in digital, it's never going to be a higher resolution than it is. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about film is. And I just was so blown away by watching Apocalypse Now and the color and the look of everything for this movie that's as old as it is. Like, also the color scheme, just the grays and the browns mean that fire looks so orange. Uh-huh. And like the purple smoke looks so purple. But I wanted to mention The Godfather 1 and 2, Apocalypse Now, and North by Northwest are actually four of the most beautiful Blu-rays I've ever seen because of the restoration and the remastering that they've done on it. And obviously, you think, what's a great Blu-ray? You think Lord of the Rings or Fury Road or something. But I also think there is something astounding about the work that's been done on some of these older movies and how nice they can look today in a way that is just as gripping and as beautiful as a movie that is shot in the most high def available thing there is.
There's a Tom Scott video on YouTube where he talks about, you know, recently all these studios went back and did remasters of music videos from 10, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the tragedy of certain videos, such as Smash Mouth's All-Star, can never be above 480p.
Wow.
We could do a whole hour on the tragedy of that.
Next to LTS video.
I do want to say the one thing that I like that fascinates me about this movie, or it is just something that we've talked about a few times before, which is the simplicity of the story, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it reminds me of, it, I think it's supposed to, but it reminds me not just of the Joseph Conrad novel, but it reminds me of the Odyssey. Like, it's supposed to be, you know, there's like the sirens are there, and the Playboy bunnies, and then there's like the natives that are standing on their canoes and things, like guarding the gates of hell almost, right? Like, it has this very classical, simple, O'Brien, go ahead.
Which is why Coppola called it the Idiocy.
Right, he did, yeah, the Idiocy. But yeah, just going back to, if you're going to undertake something that's really ambitious in one way, it's super smart to go simple with it in another way, like in this sort of foundational way. And so like, even though I really like how this movie ends, it almost doesn't even really matter how it ends. Do you know what I'm saying?
Like, sure. Right.
The fact that they were willing to dive into it and make it without an ending tells you that the ending kind of didn't really matter. It's about the descent. It's not really about what you learn when you get to the bottom. It's about what that looks like. Right. Diving all the way down into the depths of the human psychology, the heart of darkness, you might say. It has to do with that. And so when you have this very simple narrative form, the episodic structure works, as we talked about with Llewyn Davis. The imagery is classical imagery. So you're referencing, it's illusion. It's something we're all familiar with. And then you also can work with a Brando, who's the person waiting at the end, you know, because what happens to him is more, it's more about what happens to Willard. It isn't really about what happens to Kurtz.
Mm-hmm. And you just talking about the ending, the original ending, as they talk about the documentary, was Willard and Kurtz like fight off the Viet Cong, and then the American helicopter shows up, and then Willard shoots down the helicopter and says, "I fought too hard for this," and he's basically gone full Kurtz, as the kids say. Mm-hmm. I think either ending is fine. I think that is an interesting ending to just say it's kind of like The Godfather. He has gone completely corrupt and he has become the thing he never wanted to be. Also thought it was interesting that Harvey Keitel was initially cast.
Yeah.
And then they decided to go another way. And I think Harvey Keitel's a great actor, but he has a rigidness and a harshness to him. Whereas Martin Sheen has sort of an innocence and a lightness to him where he's
President Bartlett.
It's President Bartlett. Yeah. It's more interesting to watch, nothing against Harvey Keitel, of course, but it's more interesting to watch someone like Martin Sheen go on this descent than it is kind of like The Shining, where we talked about if you cast Jack Nicholson, you're already setting the audience up for crazy. Right.
It's not a secret what's going to happen.
And, yeah. and whether or not that's the right choice, I don't know. But it's more interesting to sort of see the polarity that a character can go through over the course of a film.
Right. And I do want to say that despite the episodic structure, it's not like this movie doesn't have any momentum or like a build.
Right.
It does build. It does get increasingly worse.
Sure.
And maddening. And the scene where they stop that boat and it's the worst. Yeah. And then they find the puppy after they've murdered everybody on the boat. Actually, I would venture to say, I'd be interested to know, is that the midpoint?
I checked. Yep. It was around
you guys checked it?
Yep.
It's like that. Yes, perfect. It's exactly that moment where you're like, this will not end well. These guys are not coming back from this mission, at least not psychologically, even if they physically come back from this mission, because they've just killed all of these innocent people. It's awful.
Yeah. And coming off of Sunset Boulevard and Parasite, we talked about the sort of the midpoint decision. Mm-hmm. And I think you have Lawrence, quote, Larry Fishburne as Mr. Clean, and he needlessly kills all these people. And then he is needlessly killed. You know, he actually said he thought his character in the film was there to represent the kids who were there, who just didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly.
Right. But then you also have Willard making his midpoint decision where he kills that woman, where that's sort of the first moment where you see him do something that sort of feels like the point of no return. And I think that is what a midpoint does. I don't know if Francis Ford Coppola thought about midpoints when he's making this crazy all over the place movie with three different cuts, but it certainly feels at least watching it in 2020, it feels like that is the moment where this character, the turning point. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
Again, in the documentary, they talk about how it was the actors that wanted to have a scene like that.
Yeah.
So it kind of came from them, and that, like, it's usually a terrible idea to listen to the actors that much, but like in this situation, I feel like it really paid off, and it was so smart for all the reasons you just said.
Well, we have the sense, and I feel like there's this natural rhythm to, or this and this is just like a conversation for another time, but we've talked before about the psychology of storytelling and sort of the naturalness, like how we sense narrative and how we sense what like a journey is and what an arc is, and like there's a reason why our stories take the form that they do. It's something very deeply embedded in the human psyche, either just from our ancestors or something else. And so it doesn't surprise me that the actors probably in this case were sensing there has to be a shift here, like we're halfway there and we need to know, like, something. We have to start that downturn into the dark place that this is going to go. And then, everyone starts to die one by one.
Have I talked about at all the feature film that I made in the high school /
a bit? Yes, you have.
Okay.
421.
Okay. Yeah. And have I talked about how I recently discovered that we created a midpoint, like almost exactly
interesting.
What you were saying? Mm. All this is to support what you were saying about, like, I think there's some kind of intrinsic, either from the society that we live in or deeper just to human psychology, where we can feel certain things. And so I made in high school, I wrote this crazy feature film. We shot it this one summer. It was awful. We put it away. And then the next summer, a friend and I came back and we kind of did probably what a lot of Apocalypse Now editing was, which was like, okay, what's working, what isn't, get rid of everything that's not. And then we like realized there were certain things that just felt like they were missing. And one of the scenes that we added was one of the scenes I was very proud of at the time. And so I recently was going back and scrubbing through, and I realized that scene that we added is exactly at the midpoint. And the thing that happens in that scene is exactly the main character making a choice that they cannot come back from. Mm-hmm. And it like spooked me almost, that me from 15, 20 years ago, whatever, just intuitively could feel something like that needed to happen. And so I like it when those things reveal themselves to just kind of confirm that structure isn't, you know, a
arbitrary
thing that somebody wrote in a book and now we apply. Like it's tapping into something deeper that we feel is missing if it's not there in a story that we're being told.
I love that there's like an origin story for your midpoints
fixation. it blew my mind. I was like freaking out and wanted to tell people, and no one was around that would care or understand.
Another
day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Awesome. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Apocalypse Now? Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Trisha already started us off with talking about the simplicity of the story. And I think that was the thing that struck me was people talk about the length of a movie. And I think that sometimes length is not the key thing. It's how lost are we and how much energy do we need to output in order to follow this thing. And I think that Apocalypse Now is one of the biggest movies ever made. And yet it's built on the simplicity of this singular mission where a character, you know, inciting incident, has to do this thing, at the end does the thing. The entire time, doesn't matter what's happening, we know that he just needs to get from point A to point B to achieve a goal. Doesn't even matter whether he does in the end. It's just we know that that's what he is striving to do. And then on the way, you have these vignettes, which are sort of separate from each other. So you have your Robert Duvall and you have your USO Playboy show and you have your Dennis Hopper. You have all these vignettes along the way. And each of those is a fairly straightforward, simple, not overly complicated story. And then, you know, like Robert Duvall shows up and Martin Sheen takes a back seat for 10 minutes. He's not even in the movie almost. It's just all the Robert Duvall show, the Kilgore show, because that's where we are right now. We're focused on this one thing, but he doesn't come back. They're gone. We don't need them. We don't need those characters to come back. We got our time with them. And then you have the rest of the crew on the boat. We don't know their backstories. We don't know that much about them. We don't have these B and C and D plots that are about what they're doing. They're there and they represent a certain character from this war. You know, they each play their part, but there's not this overcomplicated storytelling about who all of them are. And I just think it's like, once you know exactly what's going on at any given moment and where we are, then it allows the movie to be long and moody and artistic and thematically heavy and all this kind of stuff without feeling too exhausting, because your brain is not trying to do all that extra work to try to keep track of all these plot lines. You have this one singular thread that you're following, and then your brain is allowed to just enjoy everything else that's going on, the mood and the music and the action and the character moments and all of that stuff. And I just think that it's just such a great example of how much mental real estate you get by keeping your story simple, that allows you to do so much more. Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely. Cool. Alex?
Yeah, I think I've already kind of touched on my lesson a bit, but I think what struck me about this film was how so much of, I think, the statement the film is making about Vietnam and about war and about America and any of the like overarching themes or statements are communicated so much, not through even what's said or what's even in the text, as much as just the raw experience of the film itself, which I think is really impressive and really interesting. The idea that even the headspace you put an audience into through the way you're portraying the situation, like, can be in itself the statement, can be in itself the theme. And so that was just a really interesting lesson to take away for myself of, you know, if there's a situation in a film like Vietnam, like, you know, like a time and place that you want to say something about, you can say something about it, not even through the, you know, on the surface dialogue, but just through what kind of an experience is this cinematically. And that is the statement.
For sure.
That is what was so cool about this movie, and I can't wait to rewatch it. Actually, I want to see the final cut and compare, and I'm just so
curious.
I
do too now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, Trisha.
Mine is like, I guess the oversimplified way to say it is just go with your gut. I mean, if there was ever a movie that teaches that, it's this one.
Don't try this at home, kids.
Go with your gut and get really lucky.
Go with your gut. Don't make a movie this way. Those two things at the same time. I don't know. I was really struck when I was watching Hearts of Darkness, the documentary. There's a moment, I think it's like three quarters of the way through, where Coppola is talking about not wanting to make something pretentious. Mm-hmm. And he's like, the artist is pretentious. And if it's pretentious, then it's not useful to anybody. And so, like, I don't want to be pretentious. But then I realized, like, I just have to make what I am making. And if it's pretentious, then that's what it's going to be. And, like, honestly, he's so pretentious. And, like, he was so pretentious at Cannes when he won the jury award that, there was at least, like, one reporter, like, famous film critic that got up and left because he was just so disgusted by, like, the way that Coppola was talking about his own movie. which is fine and valid. But just that, like, I feel as a filmmaker, like, or as a writer, I also get very into my head about, like, what are people going to think about this? What are they going to think about this? Like, is this pretentious? Is this, like, too intellectual or heady? Or is it, like, am I manipulating it too much? And, you know, time and again, in the course of learning about how this movie got made, we see from Coppola just a double down and a double down. You know, adhering to his instinct to fire Harvey Keitel. On the documentary, his wife is like, I went upstairs for 15 minutes to put the children to bed. And when I came back down, he had decided to fire Harvey. And, like, that is a gut reaction that obviously wasn't thought all the way through necessarily. It was just, he was watching the footage and is like, this doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously take it with a grain of salt. Like I said, don't make a movie this way. But there are clearly instincts, good instincts at work here that Coppola is listening to. I'm a very instinctive writer myself, so that's normally not my problem. But the older that I get, the more that I'm, you know, when I was very young, I was exclusively instinctive. And now that I'm older, I find those two things wrestling sometimes. And so it's just kind of a good word here.
Yeah.
A little aside about that, I've sometimes heard, like, you know, there's kind of like your head brain, but also like your gut brain. Like there's this kind of like science has now proven that the bacteria in your gut interacts with your brain. So you literally have a gut brain. So scientifically, Michael, we can listen to our guts sometimes is what I'm saying. Because science. Yes.
I think it's also important to feed your gut things so that it knows what the hell it's talking about.
Yes.
So you can rely on what it's telling you.
Some good, you know.
Some good movies.
Yeah, prebiotic movies.
Yes. Oh boy. Awesome. Cool. Well, yeah. So my lesson is pretty short because it's what Trisha and Brian, you've already said, which was because of the way this movie was made, I feel like there isn't a ton of like, what are repeatable lessons that you can take away from this experience? But the one thing I wrote down was like, exactly what you guys were saying. It's long and like maybe teeters on what is you could call boring at times, maybe. Like I'm engaged, but it's not like I'm not entertained constantly. But I want to know what's going to happen when they get to the end of the road.
Yep.
And it's just like as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron, we kind of like Saving Private Ryan also has a similar kind of thing. I think there's more plot happening kind of in Saving Private Ryan. But there is this sort of thing of like, are they gonna find Ryan? Like, it's just a very simple thing that then lets you, as we've said, take these detours and view them through the eyes of the people that are on this journey and have that be where so much of the meaning is created.
Yeah.
And that kind of dovetails into what I'm watching. Mm-hmm. So I'll just go with that. So on Netflix, there is a series called Middleditch and Schwartz, the improv show by Thomas Middleditch and Ben Schwartz, right? Yeah. And it's an improv show that they've, you know, did live and have done live for several years, and I've almost seen it a couple times, and I have like a improv background. That sounds extremely pretentious, so I'm going to dramatically qualify that.
Wow. Okay.
Which is in high school, we had an improv team, and I tried out for it to impress a girl I had a crush on, and then accidentally made the team and then had to do improv. And I was not good at it, but that's also where I met all of my friends that I've then had for forever. And so I do have like a knowledge of like what improv is more than the average person. Anyway, so watching improv be done, and this is like long form improv where it's just the two of them. They come on stage, they interact with the audience and ask questions. So they like pick someone and they're like, what's going on in your life? And they're like, well, I'm getting married and I have a my best friend is not going to be there and blah, blah, blah. And then they do a, like a 45-minute show that they're making up that incorporates those things.
Mm-hmm.
And wow. It's hilarious. First of all, you're just laughing constantly. But I think it's also a really interesting examination of storytelling. And if you can watch yourself while you're watching it, I think it speaks to what we were talking about earlier, this intuitive sense mm-hmm. of like what story is and when it's working and when it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are moments, you know, I think it's especially in this second episode they did, it took them a while to find what the narrative was. And the whole time it was funny and I was laughing, but there was also just something in me that was like, yeah, but like, where's this going? And like, how long am I going to be here? Like, I'm laughing, but like, what's happening? And then there's a moment, there's a very clear moment where I believe it's Ben Schwartz is basically like, oh, there's this thing behind this door. Why is it locked? We need to figure out what's inside this door. And then suddenly I could feel like myself uh-huh. lean forward of like, well, it's insane that there's maybe an alien behind this door because we're in a law school and it doesn't make any sense. But I want to know what's behind this door. And so suddenly I was engaged. Mm-hmm. And so it was just an interesting kind of unexpected place to find an examination of story structure at work and when it's working and when it isn't in this completely other realm that I feel like you can access from a different place and be laughing the whole time. So Middle Ditch and Schwartz, highly recommend.
I recently went to the Largo Theater. Well, recently, earlier this year, I went to the Largo Theater and saw the Improvised Shakespeare Company, which was co-founded by Thomas Middle Ditch, where they take a suggestion from the audience and they turn it into an entire hour long Shakespeare play with Shakespearean dialogue and settings and characters. And it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
That is impressive.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, besides that, Brian, what have you been watching lately?
So maybe a little obvious, but I've been watching Some Good News, John Krasinski's YouTube show. And I think that it's really a beautiful thing to exist. And I was thinking, again, as you talked about, Michael, like watching yourself watching something, like why am I experiencing what I'm experiencing? And for anyone who doesn't know, is probably very few of you, but it's just during everything that's going on, Krasinski is in his home shooting himself on an iPhone with a logo made by his kids and just reporting about cool things that are happening in the world that are good news. And then every episode has like a guest appearance from the cast of Hamilton or Steve Carell or something. So there's always that little element to it, which is fun. But it's like, why am I super engaged for 20 minutes just watching people be happy? I mean, you think, why wouldn't you be? But in screenwriting, we talk so much about conflict. We talk about we are excited when things are not right. And then when conflict is resolved, then we're done watching a thing. Like, we don't need to watch it anymore. The dramatic question has been answered. The conflict is resolved. We can move on. Credits, we're happy. But then I was thinking in recent episodes, When Harry Met Sally and Butch and Sundance, I think, are two that come to mind. We talked about how much we just like watching characters enjoy each other and just mm-hmm. be happy. And you don't want to watch that for a two-hour movie, I understand. But there is whatever chemical we get from conflict. We also get a similar chemical from just joy and watching things that are nice. And you tell someone about your vacation, you're like, oh, this and this and this. And then you kind of inevitably go to, well, but the only bad thing that happened was this. Like, why do you need to tell the bad thing? Well, we need to like inject conflict into this slideshow of, you know, whatever. So it was just, it's very refreshing to watch something that celebrates fun and love and joyful situations. And I think it's something we can take a lesson from that people do want to watch that, because every week it was the number one like trending thing on YouTube. And now it's been picked up by CBS All Access, and Krasinski's not going to be the main host. They're probably going to have a budget, which will be weird, but still very much supported as an overall idea and a concept. And I think something that we should get behind.
Yeah. Awesome. Trisha, what have you been watching?
A couple things. I was asked to guest on a couple of different podcasts recently. Which Ooh. Should both be out or coming out by the time you guys are listening to this. So the first is that I was asked by our buddy Sean Eastridge to come back on Missing Frames, which is his podcast about movies that we should have watched by now. And actually, this time, it wasn't me watching a movie I hadn't seen. It was Sean watching a movie he hadn't seen. And so we watched West Side Story from 1961, mainly from our like angle of wanting to talk about Spielberg. Are you trying
I'm in my head, I'm singing and I'm trying to get the energy out.
Snapping is what you should be doing.
Well, no,
snapping.
There's the part where they like stomp.
Oh.
They like do a whole thing. That's what
Michael
I'm doing.
Michael is really into this right now, you guys.
Totally. So. Anyway, so because Spielberg is remaking it, it's in theory coming out. He's making a version of it. It's in theory coming out in December this year. And so Sean and I wanted to get into West Side Story. So that was an awesome conversation hearing from Sean, someone who had seen it for the first time. And then I also on Saturday, but it should be coming out quite soon, I'm going to be on Oxide Film, which is an Oxford University film podcast that you, Michael, and Alex have been on before. So I'm going to get to go talk about Birdman and Iñárritu like a little bit more broadly and his career. So I'm very, very excited to chat about that. So I've been rewatching like basically all of Iñárritu's movies, which are cheery.
That's intense.
It's fun. A lot of fun.
Lots of fun to watch them all back to back to back. But yeah, very, very fascinating. And I can't wait to chat to the lovely hosts of Oxide Film about that. So check those out.
Cool. Alex, what have you been watching?
I've been checking out Tales from the Loop on Amazon Prime.
Oh, interesting.
Which is, it's a really interesting approach to an anthology series. I should have double checked this, but I heard that essentially the idea for the show spawned from some like European artist who was just doing interesting drawings of like retro robots in rural settings. And somebody took that and was like, I'm inspired to make a show. So the show has a really interesting look. It all the stories in this kind of anthology series take place in this small rural town somewhere that's in this kind of Twilight Zone alternate reality kind of retro futuristic tech thing going on. And the other interesting thing about it is that it's not necessarily entirely separate stories. It's like you'll see a character from the next episode is a supporting character in this story, but the next episode is like their story. And each episode kind of has its own Twilight Zone spin of like a what if, you know, kind of with this magical retro technology. So it's really lovely and it's really beautifully shot. It sometimes can kind of move too slowly. There's definitely a lot of like, hey, we have really nice cameras and nice music and we're going to really, you know, do that for a while. Kind of Handmaid's Tale style. But I would say overall, I'm actually really enjoying just the kind of meditative, interesting mood it casts. And I'm curious to see how it all adds up. Because I do sense that it's like all going to come together by the end. So yeah, if you're into kind of meditative sci-fi, worth checking out.
Nice.
Very cool. Well, this has been our conversation about Apocalypse Now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you to the patrons for supporting the show, making this possible. We'll see you next time. I think there's only one way that we can all end this episode. It's by saying together, the horror.
The horror. The horror.
I wasn't sure what you were going to say.
Not going to do it. Thanks. Not going to happen.
The horror.
I told myself we'd go for it. See, this, you experiment. You just do things. Sometimes you cut it out. Sometimes you leave.
That was his gut brain.
Yeah. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.